Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Doug Sovereign, political reporter at KCBS Radio in San Francisco and your moderator for this program. I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Joan Walsh. She is editor-at-large of Salon.com, appears frequently as a political analyst on MSNBC and other networks, and she's the author of the new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Ms. Walsh has had a distinguished career as a political journalist. She's worked in government at the state capitol in Sacramento. She was editor-in-chief at Salon for 6 years. She is quite proudly from New York City, where I'm happy to say that her father and mine grew up on the very same street near Yankee Stadium, and not a major street at that. And she is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. Ms. Walsh is here to discuss her ideas on the demographics and alliances at play in this election year and give us her take on what the possible outcome might be. Please give a Commonwealth Club welcome to Joan Walsh.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks, everybody. I told my best friend who's here tonight that I was nervous about this, that I've been doing all sorts of things and not getting nervous. And then I told Twitter. I tweet a lot. And somebody reminded me that yesterday was the 80th anniversary of FDR's most important speech at that point in his life. In 1932, he was running for the presidency, and he came out and said that a big defining difference between him and Herbert Hoover was that he was really going to use government to help people and get us out of the Great Depression. So no pressure there. I think I was nervous before, but then hearing that, whatever, that's a piece of cake. I get a lot of laughs. I heard people, every time the title was mentioned, people chuckled. And Chris Matthews said it today, and he chuckled and said, that is just a funny title, even though he said it like 9 times. It's funny every time. That's okay. And I realize that there are three actual meanings to the title, and I'm only getting to talk about one for the most part. The first meaning is sort of the title itself. What's the matter with white people? What's wrong with them? Why are 9 out of 10 self-identified Republican voters today white in a country that is 62% white? And that's a question that I've been thinking about a lot. I've been writing for Salon, for Image Magazine back in the day. I don't know if David Talbot is here. Yes, he is. I've been really for a long time struggling with exactly why that FDR coalition, that New Deal coalition, fell apart. And looking at it through the lens of my working class Irish Catholic family, some of whom started the 60s as staunch JFK Democrats and ended it as Nixon supporters, and they later became the famous Reagan Democrats, and now they're just plain old Republicans. There's no Democrat in their affiliation in any way. They don't remember that they were ever Democrats. And so that's the meaning of the title that gets a lot of attention, and thanks to Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, it got a lot of attention in Tampa. I think people literally rushed to Google after watching the convention and typed in, what's the matter with white people, and got the book. So I want to thank them. But, a lot of the commentary about Tampa focused on the nostalgia Republicans seem to feel for a golden age. As I describe in my title, and we can say that that's racism or sexism, and some of it no doubt is. But I think it's important for us as progressives, those of us here who are progressive, I hope we have some Republicans too, I think it's important for us to think about what the golden age was, and that there was a golden age for some Americans, and it really coincided with my growing up. I feel like I was the last generation of people to whom the country really kept its promises. Although if Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan get elected, they'll break those promises to me since I'm just under 55. We'll have a chance to break promises to me, too. I'll get to feel like everybody else. It'll be great. But the Golden Age, when we think about it, really was a result of the Great Depression and World War II. It was the result of people feeling as though those tragedies and those traumas created an incentive to create a big middle class, that we didn't want communism and we didn't want fascism, and the way to prevent that was to give more American people a stake in society and let them be less susceptible to those sort of isms and those sort of extremisms. And so we used government, we the people, used government to build that great middle class. We started with the New Deal and making it easier to unionize. The GI Bill actually let people buy houses and go to college. It wasn't just veterans who could go to college. We were building public universities. We were, the federal government was insuring home mortgages for people who maybe couldn't have previously afforded them. And we built the roads out to the great suburbs that some of us had our golden age. The problem with that time period, though, is that it left out a lot of people. It particularly left out African Americans and Latinos, who were either actually excluded from those programs, or those programs, despite lobbying by the liberals of the day and the NAACP, those programs just did not prohibit discrimination. We know that some of the suburbs that we went out to have our golden age had restrictive covenants. And so a lot of white people don't remember the extent to which government helped them rise. My Irish Catholic immigrant family rose from desperate poverty to the middle class in literally one generation. But you've got this divide where a lot of white people don't realize that they got help, and then you have African Americans and Latinos pointing to the help that they got, and you've got this terrible communication gap. How can you say you didn't get something that I don't even know I got? So that's a big problem that I wanted the book to start to talk about. The other thing that I think we don't think about enough, and part of the first meaning of the title, is the extent to which we all, many of us, congratulate ourselves on the movements of the 60s, and we should. The civil rights movement was the greatest movement of my lifetime. Feminism is why I'm standing here. We were right to stop the Vietnam War. We did the right thing. But the 60s were not sort of an unbroken narrative of victory and happiness. The 60s were kind of scary for a lot of people, and not just white people. Their crime did rise. There were urban riots. The fringe of the mainly white anti-war movement got violent. Divorce rates climbed. There was a sense that the country was unraveling. And one of the things that I think happened is Democrats were in charge. Democrats were engaged in the Great Society and a new round of government activism. And so because they were in charge when these things seemed to fall apart, they got blamed. And a lot of people, I think, blamed the wrong things for the way society seemed to fall apart. We were beginning to see offshoring and deindustrialization. People didn't realize it yet, but those blue-collar jobs were going away. And so you had this constituency of people who then became Republicans. Government help was racialized. White people didn't get help, hadn't gotten help. These newcomers, African Americans and Latinos, got all the help. And we really wound up with a situation where my relatives and many white working class people actually voted for policies that dismantled the opportunity structure that they had used to rise. And we've seen this over the last 30 years, and it all came crashing down around us with the 2008 banking crash. So, okay, that's the first meaning of the title, and a lot of us liberals are used to that meaning. But the second meaning actually comes from a conservative critique. We now have a conservative critique of white people, seriously. And it's basically, what's the matter with white people? When did they become so shiftless and lazy? We saw last year Charles Murray, a writer who was really intellectually responsible for a lot of the foundations of Reaganism and that notion that we fought a war on poverty and poverty won. Charles Murray really stigmatized African Americans in particular and tried to show that poverty programs made black poverty worse by discouraging marriage and encouraging indolence and people to stop working and go on the dole. And so I thought that that was racist, and a lot of us tried really hard and actually succeeded in refuting his data was garbage, but his message really carried. But lo and behold, last year I'm reading his newest book, Coming Apart, The State of White America. And you know who's lazy and shiftless and relying on the dole and not getting married and having kids out of wedlock? Well, it's the white working class. They're the ones who are falling out of stability and prosperity, not because the economy changed or not because their jobs went away, but because they are their own moral failings. And lest you think that that's kind of a fringe thing or Charles Murray is a scholar, first of all, he's a bestseller. That book was a bestseller, just like all of his books, because the right buys books and we don't, so buy books. I'm not any particular book. I'm not talking about anyone in particular. But liberals need to buy more books. But it's not a fringe sentiment because I started hearing echoes of it on the primary campaign trail. You had Rick Santorum come out and say that the problem in the country was dependency, that when the family falls apart, the economy falls apart, and rather than the other way around, that it's harder to have stable families when the economy is falling apart. You had Newt Gingrich call Barack Obama the food stamp president, and those of us who heard a dog whistle in that and a racial coding, we were right. We were absolutely right. But Newt Gingrich was also right when he said, hey, I'm not talking about black people. Look at all the white people. The number of white people and the percentage of white people on food stamps is also skyrocketing. Again, we have a dependent country. Paul Ryan was talking about the makers versus the takers. And that was, again, saying that some people have productive lives and some people live off the rest of us, a very Ayn Randian notion of the world, very juvenile and very untrue. And then you have the culmination, I think, just a week ago, in Mitt Romney talking about the 47%. And I am not, I don't read anything. I carry this speech just so it's like a security blanket, I clutch it. But I just have to read this so I'm really sure that I get it right. I mean, the worst sentence in Mitt Romney's little oration in Boca Raton with his rich friends was, I'll never convince them that they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives. That's what he said about 47% of Americans. He holds half the country in contempt. And so the chickens have kind of come home to roost for the white working class that's given its votes to this party that now holds them in the same contempt that they hold minorities. And so that brings me to the third meaning of the title, and that is, you got to say it with a little bit of a Brooklyn or a Bronx accent or Jersey, and it's kind of, what's the matter with white people? Aren't we good enough to join your multiracial progressive coalition? And that's the most controversial part, I think, of my book, and the one that's getting the least attention, which is interesting. But I really felt during the 2008 primary that when Hillary Clinton was succeeding in getting a large portion of the white working class vote and bringing them back to the Democratic Party, the default for a lot of people on the left was to call that racism. The only reason those people were voting for her was because they wouldn't vote for a black man. Now, we all know that is absolutely true for some people, but I didn't think it was true for a majority of people, and it brought home to me something that I'd been feeling living in San Francisco for a long time, and going back to the stories that I did for Image and Salon, and realizing that our sort of black-white, literally, race relations paradigm really wasn't working in a state, certainly, where the fastest-growing groups are Latinos and Asians. And I felt, and I grew to feel, even in the 90s, and certainly before this primary, that our language was really exclusionary, and that white liberals in particular seem to be never happier than when they can scapegoat and put down the white working class and show that they're the good white people. And those ignorant people are the trouble. And so I began to think about why we continue to use such exclusionary terms about politics. I began to get really irritated, I'm sorry, with the idea that we were going to have a great people of color coalition, as though Laotian dentists and African-American investment bankers and Mexican-American cops had more in common with each other than with any white Americans. Although I guess people of color could include white people because I guess that's a color. But anyway, it tends not to when in the ways that we use it. I came to really believe that we liberals gave up the language of inclusion and the language of unity and the language of common ground and common vision. For some good reasons, we became the people focused on difference, but that was something that maybe we've outlived the necessity for being those people. And certainly I came to feel in the course of writing this book, and more strongly in the last few weeks, months, that Democrats have a real opportunity to speak to this constituency that left them a long time ago. And I don't ever like to say I told you so, except of course I do, because we all do. But there was a poll last week that showed that the president is competitive with the white working class. If you take the South out of the equation, which is a difficult thing to do, but if you take out Southerners, President Obama is leading Mitt Romney in the Midwest. Thank you, auto restructuring, probably. And he's basically tied in the Northeast and the West. And then, thank you, Paul Ryan. Today I saw a Reuters poll that shows that Romney has he's gone from being 20 points ahead with voters over 60 to being 4 points ahead in just a couple of months. So even white, they've managed to even turn off and alienate the core of their base, I have to say, white seniors. So I feel like it really does create a new opportunity for liberals to be the people who are talking about an inclusive America, an America that works for all of us, including white working class people, to put government back on the side of creating a middle class, to recognize what government did, to stand up for it, and to be the ones who are really the people who believe in American exceptionalism, frankly, and that we can have a just and prosperous multiracial America, that our country isn't going to fall apart, didn't fall apart when we became so diverse, that our diversity is a strength, which is what they used to say, that e pluribus unum thing, which they seem to have lost heart on when the pluribus is so diverse. And I think the challenge for white people too, in the culture wars, the age of the culture wars, we heard a lot about the left has given up on e pluribus unum, out of many one. But I think the challenge for a lot of white people is, do we really like that term, and will we accept being just one out of many, not the dominant norm to which everyone else is supposed to conform? I think what we've really seen, and we see so much in California, and we see with our children in particular, that that assimilation goes both ways, and that we are influencing each other and creating this really amazing mestizo culture in every way that's going to make us stronger, and that we're the ones who have to be talking about that, and talking to all people, including white people. So I'm going to wrap it there and leave a lot of time for questions. And we even think you're a trustworthy enough audience that you get to go to the microphones, which is a very cool thing here. I've been a moderator before, and usually, but Doug is just so good at this. He's they trust him to reel you in if you get out of control. So anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joan Walsh, Salon.com's editor-at-large, MSNBC analyst. I read all your titles every time.
Okay.
And author of the new book, What's the Matter with White People? Or, as she said, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Okay, so now it's time for our questions from you. And we have a few here to get started with, and I'll probably come up with some of my own. But let's ask one of these from the audience. One person would like to know, can we have a democracy without a middle class?
It's very hard. I think that is why we decided to create one after the twin traumas of a terrible depression and the worst war that we'd ever seen. I think that it's very hard to have a country where economic power is so concentrated in the hands of very few, and they then rig the game to make sure that it continues, both economic and political power continues to be concentrated there. I mean, my book is critical of Democrats in some ways. If you want to know why Mitt Romney pays a scandalously, disgustingly low tax rate, you need to talk to some Democrats, that people I like and admire, like Chuck Schumer, who really, the Democrats became the party of Wall Street in many ways, and walked away from their legacy. And there's a reason that people stopped trusting them to look out for the interests of working people and middle class people.
the politicians all pander to the middle class. All you ever hear about is the middle class, the middle class tax cut. But that's a shrinking number of people as we have this stratification, the very rich and the very poor. You touch on this in the book, but what impact do you think the Occupy Wall Street movement is having now, a year later, as opposed to when it initially began with such fervor?
I was very inspired and moved by Occupy Wall Street. I was very inspired by how inclusive it was. You know, unlike some of the protests of the 60s, the cops in some cities were horrible, but by and large, the protesters went out of their way to include the cops. I saw signs saying, you know, you're part of our 99%. I think that the notion, we are the 99%, became kind of an updated version of E Pluribus Unum. And that it honestly, absolutely, incontrovertibly changed the rhetoric, changed the political dialogue. I mean, I never talked about income inequality. Those two words, you know, you didn't get to talk about those things on cable news. And suddenly, I mean, people did studies, and literally the mention of income inequality just skyrocketed in the months after Occupy. I guess, you know, I came out of the closet as many things in this book, working class Irish Catholic, and also, you know, a really staunch Democrat, and I don't hide that in any of my journalism. And so there is a part of me that wishes that Occupy would have at least devoted more of its energy toward the left wing, Michael Harrington's famous formulation, the left wing of the possible. You know, and that's very two-party centric of me, but that is what we have in this country. And so I think a lot of us hope that they would become the left-wing Tea Party and pull the Democrats to the left the way that the Tea Party has pulled the Republican Party to the right. And that mostly hasn't happened. You know, I went to Occupy Oakland a couple of times and saw people exclude anyone who worked with the Democratic Party, anyone who worked with unions. You know, it became more of a scarlet letter to have worked with unions than to be an anarchist who wanted to break windows. And I at that point, you know, lost some hope. But honestly, in other cities, in Tampa, I went to Tampa, Occupy Tampa is working with Planned Parenthood on reproductive rights issues. And I think that that's happening in other cities as well, that people did get politicized, and some people, despite the kind of formal animosity towards the Democratic Party and organized politics, some people did get swept into causes. And I hope more of that happens.
As the "we are the 99%" chants have faded a bit, are we going to start to hear "we are the 47%"? Is this going to be out there over the next couple of weeks? Romney's going to be dogged by protesters with signs.
Yes, I mean it's already happening. Actually, he's been heckled. You know, there's a terrible, terrible blogger and CNN commentator named Eric Erickson who started a blog, "We Are the 53%." And this shows you how long Mitt Romney's 47% formulation has been around. Right after Occupy, he started this blog to show that we are the 57% who pay taxes and take care of you 47%. So, you know, this has really crystallized in a new way this new extremist Republican contempt for half the country.
So we were both in Tampa at the Republican National Convention and then in Charlotte. The Republican Convention, I mean, those two conventions and the parties could not have been more different. The Republican one is monolithically white. The delegation was probably 97% white, something like that.
Yeah, it was, literally.
And the Democratic Convention, it looks like America. There's a wide range of people and all races and types of people. How does the Republican Party, if they're only making only a token effort to non-whites, are they dooming themselves as the country becomes more ethnically diverse and less majority white to being a permanent minority party?
Yeah, I mean, they're on a course of demographic extinction. It won't happen necessarily right away. You know, I think this year that they are betting very strongly on it. If we have the electorate that turned out in 2008, we win. If we have the electorate that turned out in 2010, they win. And so they've been very consciously, despite Mitt Romney's insulting white people, concentrating on turning out the white older base. And then, of course, on voter suppression, counting on really, you know, and they've been quite upfront about that. We had the Speaker of the House, Republican Speaker, I think, in Pennsylvania say, you know, well, we got voter he didn't say voter suppression. I'm sorry, that's a little extreme. You know, we got that voter ID bill done. That's going to let Pennsylvania go for Mitt Romney. They're being really. Someone else said, well, you know, why should we kowtow to that African American urban machine and make it easier for them to vote? And so that is their strategy. But in the long term, of course, it's a strategy. It's a disastrous strategy.
In the short term, though, does that send a message, subliminal or not, to whites that the Republican Party is their party? So the white voters will see that and say, oh, this is my party.
I think that was that has been the signaling, and that was the point behind the use of the welfare ads. You know, I mean, not only did he lie about what Obama did, but right now the old-fashioned welfare program that helps poor women and children mainly, it's 0.07% of the federal budget. It's not. The caseload is down 58% in 15 years. We destroyed that program. You know, we can debate it all day. We destroyed that program, but they decided to resurrect welfare. You know, again, the dog whistle, and again, saying that we are the ones looking out for you, the taxpayer. But then they kind of stepped on their message with this 47% thing. I mean, about a quarter of those 47% are seniors who. Again, you know, worked to in order to now have their benefits. That's not going to sit well with the people he was trying to turn out with the welfare ads a couple weeks ago.
What about, I mean, the Republican Party does have a new generation, a younger generation of non-white up-and-coming guys. You've got Marco Rubio in Florida, Ted Cruz in Texas, Bobby Jindal, Louisiana, who are all very conservative.
Mia Love in Utah.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. You know, very impressive African-American woman from Utah.
Ultra-conservative, but super. Non-white. So does that help them at least present some image of a bigger tent as they move forward, or are they still appealing really to the same voters because of their politics and ideology?
Well, I think that assuming if Romney and Ryan lose, there's really going to be a battle for the soul of the Republican Party, and there will be people who will critique the racial appeal and the reliance on a shrinking base of voters. I mean, you know, Marco Rubio kind of, sort of tried to do it a couple of months ago. He doesn't support the Dream Act, but he did say, although he can't support the Dream Act, he did say, it does seem a little weird to me that we're going out of our way to deport young people who've worked hard and played by the rules. And Jeb Bush has criticized his party on specifically on immigration issues and being so hostile to Latinos and Asians. So I think that there will be a debate about whether this particular demographic strategy can continue. But I always predicted in 2008 that they were going to have a debate and see that they were already going on this far right course. I was wrong. So in terms of predicting what the Republican Party is going to do, I don't have a good track record, so you guys shouldn't trust me.
Although it's funny because the conservatives are already gnashing their teeth and saying, oh, if we lose this election, we got to rethink everything.
Exactly.
They didn't get the nominee they wanted. I mean, Mitt Romney was not the conservative nominee. He's the more moderate nominee from that field. So the conservatives didn't nominate this man.
And I think that's what they're going to say. They're going to say, you know, we sat still and we put up with this nominee that you guys foisted upon us, who's a Massachusetts moderate despite what he tried to become. You silenced Paul Ryan. Now they're saying, let Ryan be Ryan.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, conservatives and liberals actually agree on something. Yeah, definitely, definitely let Paul Ryan be Paul Ryan. You know, unleash him, man.
Right.
He's great. He's great for Democrats. But, you know, there's going to be a significant portion of the Republican base, if not a majority, that says exactly that. Not we went too far to the right or we pandered to white people, but we didn't go far enough to the right.
Question from the audience. Why is it that southern white middle class voters who are served significantly by Obama's policies vote Republican? Is it racism at any cost? I think that says racism.
I think you've got to acknowledge that some of it is racism. A lot of it may be racism. I think that this hostility to the Democratic Party has become so ingrained, the association of the Democratic Party with civil rights, even though civil rights was a bipartisan issue until, you know, late in the 60s. Richard Nixon got something like 32% of the black vote in 1960. And then decided to trade that for the white working class vote very successfully. And specifically in the South, you know, there's a strong association between the civil rights movement and the Democrats of today. It's very hard to win the South back.
How much of the anti-Obama rhetoric we hear do you think, I know it's hard to put a number on it, but is thinly veiled racism? I mean, when I hear someone say, Oh, Ann Romney was classier than Michelle Obama.
Oh, is she that... looks... Somebody in Tampa said she looks like a first lady.
Right.
I mean... if you want a first lady that lectures you and wags her finger at you and tells you to stop it.
It says, I love me, my women.
Or, I love you, women. Women. Right. Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really quite unbelievable. It really is. Anyway.
Well, I'm struck by, I mean, President Obama has been the president for almost 4 years now. So I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and I said, he is the president. Who cares whether he's black, white, or purple at this point?
Right.
How come so many people still can't accept we have a black president? It's like, move on.
You know, I mean, look, it was two steps forward, one step back, and that's how we make change in this country. I mean, Barack Obama got a larger share of the white vote than Al Gore or John Kerry or Bill Clinton in his first term, and a larger share of the white working class vote as well. So, you know, I think we can congratulate ourselves about that. However, there's no doubt in my mind that it triggered a terrible backlash among people who really were so isolated, they did not think it was possible that the rest of us were going to elect this black man. Like, where did that come from? How could that have happened? And certainly, I mean, I don't know, that we call it thinly veiled racism. There's out-and-out racism. There's the pictures of him with the bone through his nose. He's an African witch doctor. Then there's birtherism, which I believe is racism. Then there's all the otherism, whether he's a Muslim or he's trying to turn us into Europe. There's always, or John Sununu saying he has to learn how to be American. You know, it's not coded racism. It's racism. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think when we act as though that's the only reason anybody might oppose President Obama or question him, I think that's unfair too.
Well, what do you think? You get into this in the book a bit, but what do you think is the watershed moment at which this white voter, middle class voter, working class voter, switched parties? And was it the Reagan Democrats? Was it Nixon? When does that happen?
I think it's Nixon. I write in the beginning of the book about the Hard Hat Riot of 1970, and it's a really traumatic moment in my family because we had people on both sides of it. Right after the four students were killed at Kent State University, there was a peace march in New York at City Hall. And it was peaceful, and my father was very, very devoted anti-war person who actually went to marches. He was kind of a corporate peacenik, and he went to this march, and suddenly, out of nowhere, hundreds of hard hats came storming down the street from the World Trade Center, ironically, or I don't know what the right word is. They were building the World Trade Center, and they just began to beat the hell out of mainly the students. They really looked for the students. And this was really, you know, kind of the final falling apart of the New Deal coalition, where you just had these guys, many of whom or their fathers had been, you know, FDR supporters, believing that, you know, society was falling apart, and you had these ungrateful students rebelling, and so they were going to rebel too. And, you know, a few weeks after that, the head of their union, Peter Brennan, went to the White House with a hard hat with Richard Nixon's name on it. And Peter Brennan later left the Democratic Party, became Nixon's labor secretary. And George Meany, that moment was really, really influential in turning a lot of unions away from Democrats, so that in 1972, George McGovern, the most probably pro-labor person in our history, was largely rejected by the white working class and by a lot of organized labor. And that was just really a tragedy that broke the party in half.
But later presidential candidates have managed to turn that coalition back, and Bill Clinton captured a lot of those voters. Barack Obama captured some of them. So at this point, are they sort of swing voters? Or
they are swing voters. I think everybody would agree. And, you know, we've gone from, there was a point when I was working on the book where the Obama, the campaign was saying, you know what, we've got a strategy to win without Ohio. And I was like, you guys are crazy. You know, Barack Obama won the white working class in Ohio. You can't give up on Ohio. And subsequently, the president is leading in Ohio. So I think that a lot of the pessimism of even a year ago, where people were saying, you know, you've just got to go for this exclusively for this new Democratic coalition that's, you know, young white voters, some white, unmarried white women, but mainly non-whites. I don't think it's big enough or mobilized enough yet. It's crazy to to write off people who used to be part of your base and whose economic concerns actually mirror that of the rest of the country. I mean, I think that there's a real multiracial appeal at this point that the president can make to their economic interests as well, and that he has been making that. I would argue that some of his improvement with the white working class is obviously Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, but I think it's also that he's spoken a much more economically populist, that his message has become more populist, and he's really articulated this notion of we're all in it together, and that's the society that we stand for, rather than this kind of winner-take-all, I've-got-mine society. And I think as he's really sharpened those differences and stopped trying to be Mr. Bipartisan, I think that probably plays a role in winning people over who are skeptical.
One thing your book title made me think of was Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was a deliberate echo or not.
Yeah, it is.
I assumed it was, knowing how well-read you are. But I'm wondering, why do you think the Republican Party is so much better at getting voters to vote against their interests than the Democratic Party seems to be?
You know, I take issue with the idea that they're voting against their interests necessarily. Obviously, they're voting against their economic.
I'm speaking economically.
Right. But I think, you know, the great genius of Pat Buchanan and the Republican Party, I think, is to say, you know, we're not going to reduce you to your material status. You, white worker, have every right to believe the same thing as a wealthy white man, even if it screws you. But there's a, you know, perversely, there's a kind of egalitarianism there. And then I would also add that I think that that these voters, some of them are voting because of religion, and we shouldn't, you know, I have Irish Catholic family members who are economic populists, but will never vote for a pro-choice Democrat. They never will. And I wish that weren't true, but I don't think that we can minimize the extent to which that's a sincerely held belief that outweighs their perceived economic interests. And finally, you know, I think I've written about this and I've said this, you know, it's really amazing that these red state people are really the welfare queens now. Frankly, the red states get the most in federal dollars, but I think there are people who now are taking food stamps and wish they weren't, and, you know, kind of blame Obama or blame the government. And I think we have to accept that and think about how to talk about it differently, rather than saying they're crazy, they're voting against their self-interest.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Our guest is Salon.com editor-at-large and MSNBC analyst Joan Walsh, discussing her new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Question from the audience. You brought up religion. Someone writes that religion does not enter in political discussion in Europe, mostly, even though they have state religions in, say, France and England. Why are so many Americans, read Southerner, fixated on faith other than their own? I am not a Romney supporter, but believe his Mormon faith should have no, relativity, perhaps?
Relevance. Bearing.
Bearing. We'll call
Let's
it bearing.
Call it bearing.
Is the South still fighting the Civil War?
Wow, that's a lot of good questions that I don't have full answers for. I really don't know exactly why religion is so important in a country founded on the principle of freedom from religion. I do think that, you know, there were a lot of religious zealots among the founders. Like, there were some people who wanted freedom of religion just so later they could impose their own religion on the rest of us. You know, I think that we one of the things I think we do, liberals and conservatives, is kind of act as though the founders were this monolith, but in fact they disagreed about everything except for, you know, independence from Great Britain. In terms of, you know, Romney's Mormon religion shouldn't play a role, no, it should not. But I'm sure it is. You know, again, I've seen polls that say some of the Southern whites who won't vote for him. There was a great Reuters story about 2 weeks ago, great as in tragic, where a woman believes that Barack Obama is Muslim, but she's voting for him anyway because she'd rather vote for a Muslim than a Mormon. So I don't know. You know, is that winning? No. So, there, you know, there's no doubt.
Those polls always show, too, the one thing people won't vote for is an atheist.
Right.
I mean, an overwhelming majority of Americans say they would not vote for someone who doesn't believe in God.
Absolutely. It's the kiss of death. You don't have people coming out of the closet as atheists, especially if they want to have, you know, any kind of national ambition.
I mean, this is a country that was founded by Puritans and many of them religious zealots. They were very religious people fleeing religious persecution.
Exactly. So I think that does explain it. It's a paradox, but when you think about it, it makes sense that religion was so important to them that they fled their country of origin and made that sacrifice and suffered that much. So here we are.
Shifting gears, a question from the audience. How can the women's movement become more effective in addressing the issues facing women in America? Do you see a purpose for this movement again? Many question marks on the end. They really want to know.
Really big question, I guess. I think the women's movement has been revitalized by the attacks, particularly on contraception, to some extent abortion, and the attacks on women's autonomy and women's freedom. I think that for a long time, I consider myself a feminist. For a long time, feminists, we kind of wrung our hands over, we're an older movement, how do we get young people interested? I think Rush Limbaugh did more for feminism than we've done for ourselves. And particularly, I think, to get young women interested. And, you know, feminists went from, we had this image of being these kind of sexless, anti-men, Puritans, to use a term. Mm-hmm. And now we're sexy, slutty people who are, like, having so much sex that we need the government to pay for our contraception. And, you know, suddenly we're hot. And also suddenly young women, sadly, are realizing that they're going to have to fight battles that their mothers and grandmothers fought before them. And so I think the women's movement is newly relevant. I think the women's movement is stronger. I think that the push for pay equity and for real bread and butter issues, I think that the realization that women make up the majority of the 47%, I think that the women's movement is beginning to take more of an economic focus, not merely a reproductive rights focus, which I think is important and the right step.
Women are a majority, and they are a majority of voters.
Of voters.
Clearly, that's a block you need to win the election.
Whether did anybody tell Romney and Ryan that, though?
Apparently not.
Let's not tell them.
Well, whether it's a movement or not, they are the most... I mean, you need to win the women's vote if you're going to win the election.
Right.
Unless you've got every man to vote for you, which is not realistic. Right. And it almost seems... I mean, they're not conceding it. We saw how many women the Republican Party put up at this convention and how they say there's no war on women and
right.
I love you women. But if they're not conceding it, they're not doing that well in winning it over.
They're not doing that well. I mean, you know, there are also gulfs among women, and there's a
sure.
really huge divide between single women and married women. And Republicans have the edge, I think, still have the edge with married women. But there are more and more single women, and so that's an important edge for Democrats.
The African American male is an endangered species. Here comes a big question for you.
Okay.
It bothers me that they do not enjoy the fruits of a free society. There are many reasons. Progress is slow. Do you have any remedial suggestions?
You know, I'm going to go backwards a little bit maybe generate some disagreement. But, you know, in the book, I came to a new appreciation of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was actually mm-hmm. uniquely and perhaps in a sexist way very concerned about what was going on with African-American men. And I think the road not taken in the war on poverty was a jobs program. And I think the road not taken right now, I mean, we have structural unemployment. We have tragically high unemployment among African-American men, and particularly among young teenagers and men, young men in their 20s. And that's just a gulf that opens wider as you get older. And so... I think that they bear the brunt of this country's instinctive unconscious racism, and that having a black president has been a positive thing, but there's also a way in which, you know, he feels that he can't speak directly about the issues of African Americans and African American men. And when he does, like when he talked about Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates getting arrested in his own home, suggesting that the cops acted stupidly, maybe, he triggers a backlash. I mean, people argue, and I agree, that the horrible Trayvon Martin killing was not really a political issue until the president said that mild statement, if I had a son, mm-hmm. he would look like Trayvon. And after that, all hell broke loose. Before that, Mitch McConnell was calling for an investigation, and Republicans and Democrats alike agreed that an unarmed African-American teenager should not be gunned down. But when the president spoke up as a father, it became this polarizing issue. So we have a long way to go.
I had a black man say to me last year that I thought Barack Obama would be a black president, but he's just another white president. And he felt that he was, this was an Occupy person, he said he's just another corporate lackey, he's a big money guy, and you know he expected more, and there's a lot of bitter disappointment among progressives and those on the left. Is Obama somewhat, you know, damned if he does and damned if he doesn't? He's too moderate for the left, and he's too liberal
he's
for the right,
yeah.
And you know, he's a socialist to the right.
Yeah, I think he's got a very, very tough. He's just got a very tough line to walk to get reelected and to govern this country. And he can't be the black president. He's the American president, and he's got to be perceived as representing everyone. And you know, the right works overtime. You know, Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh called the health care reform bill reparations for black people, even mm-hmm. though the majority of the people it will help, the vast majority, obviously, are white. And so you have an industry, a hate industry, that works overtime depicting everything he does as somehow racialized, while, you know, there are genuine critics from the left, black critics and non-black, whatever, people who aren't black, who are very disappointed and do consider him, you know, too centrist. And I wouldn't call him a corporate lackey, but I have been disappointed, and especially in the first 2 years, by his inability to go back to FDR in his famous speech 80 years ago yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he was not comfortable depicting himself as someone who was really going to use government to actively change the lives of American people, and really was very interested in again, being bipartisan. I think that during the Clinton-Obama horrible primary, it was horrible for me anyway, you know, there were people in the Obama coalition and on the Obama team and perhaps Barack Obama himself, who really believed that Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton brought all that craziness on themselves, that they, whatever, they overreached with health care and they're polarizing and he has a sexual issue or two, and that somehow that intense, that vast right-wing conspiracy would not beset him. And that was crazy, and I said it was crazy at the time. Those people are going to use whatever they can, and the fact of his blackness became an excellent thing to use. So I did think that he was being a little bit naive and a little bit in love with his own powers of persuasion mm-hmm. when he worked so hard through health care reform to win over Republicans who were determined to make him fail.
Mitt Romney is the least liked major party nominee in recent years' poll show. He's got the highest unfavorability rating. If he wins, he will be the most negatively viewed person ever to win the presidency. On the other hand, Barack Obama would be the least popular incumbent to win re-election. His numbers aren't so great either. So one of them is going to make history. Either we're going to have an unpopular president with a not so great economy get re-elected against all odds, plus he's black, which is hurts him somewhat among some sector of the population, as we've learned. Or we're going to have an unliked Mormon Republican.
Well, I want to just, I'm going to push back on that.
Okay,
I mean,
ahead.
I think that Obama's approval ratings in terms of approving of the job he's done mm-hmm. are lower than he would like, and lower than other presidents at this point in their presidency. His popularity ratings are really high, and that's a huge factor that keeps him competitive even in a tough economy. People like this man.
Right.
Even white, we do. We focus a little bit too much on the crazy people. With white swing voters, you know, his likability, he's still perceived as a likable person, and that is, you know, certainly a huge advantage for him. So he's liked. The question of whether he's doing a good enough job is really what's at issue.
And that's why Mitt Romney, you'll often hear, will say, he's a nice guy, he's just not up to the job.
Right.
Because they see the poll numbers and they'll say, okay, we have to acknowledge the American people like him better than they like me.
Right.
But let's just say he's just not doing a good job,
right?
Because the American people don't think President Obama is doing such a good job. So is that the difference here, in that President Obama is personally liked? I mean, we get back to the same old, who would you rather have a beer with?
Right.
As if anyone's ever going to have a beer with President Bush, President Obama, unless they live
Skip
in Iowa.
Skip
or
Gates and Officer Crowley did. They had
true,
the beer summit, you know?
Right.
My God,
right.
Wow.
That's what it takes to get to have a beer with.
Really?
But is that the difference in this election right now, do you think, is the likability, that people just like President Obama more than they like Mitt Romney?
I think likability is, whether we like it or not, I think likability certainly matters. But the other thing that's very important is that the people think that they empathize with, you know, this, our first black president. White voters think he empathizes with them more than Mitt Romney does. And that he's going to do more for the middle class and all those things that aren't just likability, like he's got a nice smile or he's got those gorgeous daughters, that there's a little bit of more substance than I'd like to have a beer with him. I think that's extremely important. And you know it because, you know, we were in Tampa and Mitt Romney, that speech, he spent a couple of minutes reaching out to Obama voters and acknowledging that they had a lot of hope and change. And in that awful video of him with his buddies in Boca Raton, he talks about that obstacle, that, you know, there are a lot of nice people who just really like him, and, you know, so we can't push too hard on him. We can't really savage him, so to speak.
Question from the audience. What is one approach to poverty from the Democrats that appeals to working-class white people?
I think lots of approaches to poverty appeal. I mean, I think that white people support certain kinds of government intervention, certain kinds of jobs programs. The president's jobs bill is popular. He just can't get it passed. Mm-hmm. I think white people, like most people, I think, are worried about the issue of dependency and of people who don't, you know, pull their own weight. I mean, every culture has, I think it's a natural human. We're social animals, and we've always got our eye out for that person who's, you know, eating our food, but they're not helping to, you know, go out and kill the animal. And, you know, the freeloader is something that I think is almost like an archetype in our psyches as social beings who rely on each other. You know, I think that we need jobs programs. I think that we obviously need education, but we've really put, I think, way too much emphasis. Not emphasis on education, but we're asking schools to do so much when we're cutting programs, we're cutting nutrition programs, kids are going to school hungry, they're not getting health care, there are so many factors that put them behind before they even start school. And then we're saying to the teachers, catch them up. And I think that's really a way that our thinking about poverty, I think, has gotten off track, quite honestly, in the last 15 years, even among Democrats.
We had President Obama and Mitt Romney on CBS the other day on 60 Minutes. The president was expressing his disappointment that he hasn't been able to change the tone more in Washington. George W. Bush ran on, he was going to change the tone.
Right.
Everyone is always going to change the tone. Question from the audience, is Romney promising bipartisanship a bit like Lucy promising Charlie Brown she won't pull the football?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I think that he has to nod to that, but there's absolutely no evidence that he would govern in a bipartisan way. And I have to say, you know, George W. Bush, who was not elected president, in my opinion, not just opinion, who did not get a majority of the votes, may, you know, ran that way and ran as a compassionate conservative, and you really would have expected him to run as kind of to govern as a moderate, and to realize he presided over a very, very deeply divided country. And instead, he was one of the most radical presidents we've ever had. And so I expect the same thing from Mitt Romney, who's been espousing more radical right policies than George W. Bush ever did. I mean, George, just like, you know, Nixon and Reagan, George W. Bush in certain ways, you know, looks like a moderate in terms of some poverty programs, in terms of education. You know, Mitt Romney's just like very willing to slash all of that.
Romney brings up his Massachusetts experience, where he was in an overwhelmingly Democratic state, to show how he would govern as president. But of course, he only had one term in Massachusetts and didn't even seek a second.
And so. He lost interest, people say. Well, yeah, and I mean, was he really governor of Massachusetts? I mean, sometimes I've said this on TV, it's like he's in a mitness protection program because, you know, he doesn't want you to remember that he was a Massachusetts moderate who did preside over Romney Care. But then the other day he said he was the godfather of Obamacare. He goes back and forth. You know, he says women are going to have health care because they had it in Massachusetts. And then he says, oops, I didn't mean that. He's constantly flipping back and forth on whether he would continue anything that's in the Affordable Care Act. So I think, you know, he does like to periodically say, I did govern a blue state. But for the most part, he doesn't tell us what he did. If he really ran on his record, he might be somewhat appealing. You know, but he doesn't want to, so it's kind of tough to believe him when he says that.
I've just come from a couple of weeks in Massachusetts. He's not popular there.
No.
President Obama's, I think, 20-something points ahead in that state.
You know, it's amazing.
In Michigan, where Romney was born, Obama's way ahead there as well.
He's losing two of his home states. I think he likes to claim New Hampshire is another home, and he's probably going to lose New Hampshire, too. So he's also going to make history by being, like, the first guy to lose all three home states.
I do recall there was one person, I don't know, it's failing me who it is, there's been one president who lost both his home state and his birth state and still won, but it was in the 1800s, so it's pretty unusual.
It's very unusual.
I think we're ready now for people, if they'd like to ask questions themselves, as opposed to having me paraphrase them and change them into something else. We're ready to take some questions out loud, if anybody wants to go to the microphone in the aisle. Do we have one in both aisles, or just this aisle here, it looks like?
It looks
anybody
like
wants to go to this aisle here and ask to that microphone and ask a question? You can ask your question of Joan Walsh, and I promise not to cut you off too quickly, as long as there's a question mark at the end of whatever it is you say. If there's anyone who wants to get up and ask a question and is
somebody
brave enough.
Somebody from this section because you're closer and you can get there faster.
Anyone who's brave enough.
Here he is.
Step up to the microphone, and if not, I'll ask some more myself and some more of your written questions. But here's the man.
The other day, Mitt Romney made a statement which I found kind of confusing. His father was born in Mexico, and of Mormon people that went down to Mexico at some point, I guess to practice polygamy or something there. But he said, oh, it's too bad my father wasn't really a Mexican. You know, he was born in Mexico, but it's too bad he wasn't really a Mexican. What was he trying to say by that?
Well, you know what he was trying to say. I mean, because I think he actually came out and said it a little bit later in the remarks that, you know, that would be, and I forget exactly the words, but like that would be helping me politically. My God, as though it's easier to be a Latino in this country than Mitt Romney.
I know that's strange.
The poor guy. I mean, my heart just goes out to him. But yeah, he had the audacity to say that, that he'd be doing better politically if he were Latino.
Yeah, yep, that's very weird.
Very weird. Thank you.
And he did, for a while, remind people as often as he could that he had this sort of Mexican heritage when they were trying to get the Latino vote.
Right, then they gave up.
Sir, your question?
We've been hearing a lot about the whole Obama and Romney election going on, and I want to know at this point your perspective in terms of the, you know, what really empowers the president, and that's the House and the Senate.
Yeah.
And I'm really kind of have no comprehension of where the House is going.
I think that, I mean, people are being optimistic and saying it's possible that the Democrats could take the House. I don't really expect that. When you see those polls, usually it's kind of a generic ballot. You know, do you like the Democrat better? But when it gets down to your actual choices, it might not follow through. I think they're going to do well in the Senate. But, you know, when people were really upset with Barack Obama in 2010, I would say, you know, there was a little bit of rumbling, very little, about should he have a primary challenger. And, I think if you want a more progressive president, you have to elect a more progressive Congress. And I think that there's an extent to which liberals and progressives did not really understand that the majority was built on blue dog Democrats who may as well, on most economic and some social issues, may as well be Republicans. And it was a mirage that he had some kind of you know, foolproof majority.
Right. Sir?
You mentioned earlier white Catholic voters who would not vote for a pro-abortion or pro-choice, at least, candidate. Why do we see so few who go the other way and refuse to vote for or endorse an a pro-death penalty candidate?
You know, I think that's a great question. And the bishops, you know, the Catholic bishops have been very, very, very active on the issue of abortion and birth control and not terribly active on the issue of the death penalty or other aspects of Catholic social teaching. But I was encouraged in that poll I mentioned last week. It was actually a poll the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, a majority of working class, that was the one that studied working class whites, a majority of working class white Catholic voters are pro-choice. It's the mm-hmm. evangelical Protestants who really push the white working class into the anti-choice camp. So there are some encouraging signs.
You're Catholic, I'm not, but I will say when I've asked that question, what the pushback I usually get is that it's a matter of innocence. Innocent life versus a guilty criminal, and that's where they make the distinction whether they can live with the death penalty because it's someone who did something as opposed to an unborn fetus.
Right.
So your question for John Walsh?
Hi. As a fellow Irish Catholic badger, first want to say I've enjoyed your conversation. Obviously intelligent and also well-spoken. I was an Obama supporter, and I grew up kind of in two worlds. My wife looks like a very attractive Michelle Obama. My son doesn't look like Trayvon. He looks like Barack Obama himself. And I find the conversation on the left somewhat, especially around race, very patronizing, very presumptive, and frankly prejudiced. I find that, you're not having conversations about real solutions, and you refuse to interview people that have them, like candidate Gary Johnson, who offers third alternatives and freedom. And so I wonder, I would love to have a conversation with you about different solutions. And Gary Johnson will be in Berkeley tomorrow. If you'd like to interview him, I think I can arrange it. So
thank you. Yeah, I think that the book is very clear that I think that a lot of our discussion about race is condescending and patronizing. So, you know, we certainly agree on that.
Ms. Walsh, I could have sworn I saw you on MSNBC today.
You did.
Chris Matthews?
Yeah.
How'd you do that?
Magic.
Excuse me?
How did you get here from there?
Oh, I'm in a studio here. I live here, although I've been in New York for a while. But I was in a studio. I could have walked here. So they let me do this from San Francisco. I'm the luckiest person in the world.
Good. Okay. My other question is, given Governor Romney's tax record that we haven't seen just yet, is it in the public domain some way already that we would have access to, and is somebody just holding on to it?
Nope.
Right now?
He's got to release them. I mean, supposedly John McCain saw lots of years. We've all been waiting, as reporters, we've all been waiting for the leak, but we haven't gotten a leak yet.
His are no more than yours would be. It's a private matter between you and the IRS, and it's up to you if you want to let people.
And you don't think the media has that, and they're just not saying it right now?
No.
Okay. And there's nothing to compel him to show us 10 years worth.
Shame.
Nope. Shame. But
the only thing I can compel anyone
to. Shameless.
Okay. Thank you much.
Thank you.
I think we have one last question from the audience.
I feel like I've been seeing a lot more dialogue in the mainstream circles about white privilege, which I think is a really good thing. I think we need to be talking about that more. And one of the conversations that I'm starting to see develop more is really around what white people would have to give up and what that would mean. And that could go a lot of different directions, and I've seen a lot of interesting dialogue in a lot of different directions there. Do you agree that there's more of that happening, and how can we foster that in a really healthy way so that white people can start to recognize what that might look like and be more healthy about making space for people of color while recognizing that it's okay for us to, if we're giving things up, what does that look like? And just
well, you know, I guess I when I think of white privilege, one of the things is that array of programs that created the white middle class and that people don't acknowledge is white privilege. And it's also the assumption that everybody's going to, conform to our norm. But I also think that we can that some discussions, to frame it as what white people have to give up, I'd really rather frame it as what we all get, what we all, we always have this zero-sum approach to race relations, that if you get something, I have to lose something. And I think that some of those conversations on the left, quite honestly, are kind of self-flagellating and not that productive, and certainly not going to reach out to the white working class or people who feel that they don't have much privilege. They have some. We know that they have some. But, I think that we need to be more inclusive in our language about that and talk about it in terms of expanding the pie and what we all get from diversity, not what we give up.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I do want to ask you very quickly one short last question. Who's going to win the presidential election?
I'm feeling optimistic about President Obama, but I really don't know. I've been wrong before.
Okay. Our thanks to Joan Walsh, Salon.com's editor-at-large, MSNBC political analyst, author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for the Golden Age That Never Was. We want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We want to remind everyone here that copies of Ms. Walsh's new book, What's the Matter with White People?, are on sale in the lobby. She will be pleased to sign them outside this room there in the lobby immediately following the program. And we appreciate your letting her make her way to the signing table as quickly as possible, where I'm sure she would love to engage you and to talk further. I'm Doug Sovereign, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.